Right, we'll make a start. This is Paul McKinney, and I'll hand straight over to him.
Thank you. Okay, so I've been working on user-level things for quite some time, and a couple things have changed. One thing is that I actually finally, after 5.5 years, last spring, got permission to actually release some of these. You can work out the math and figure out what might have been involved there, and if you can't, somebody else might be able to tell you. In the process of doing that, I've had some experiences that have indicated that we really need user-level test structure for some RCU algorithms, and we'll talk about that in the talk. This is kind of an overview of where we're going. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time going through that, aside from talking about it. And the first question, and I talked about this a little bit on Monday for those of you who are here, is why bother with concurrency at all? And that's kind of an unfashionable question, but it's all the more important because of that. If we don't know why we're using concurrency, and if we don't have good answers for it, then we don't really know what we should be doing about it. The three reasons I've come up with, and we could debate on this, I'm happy to do that afterwards, higher performance. If the performance of a single CPU is enough for you, run single-threaded, be happy. All right? So I assert that anybody who's doing multi-core, doing parallel programming, shared memory parallel programming, has to be trying to resolve a performance problem. Non-shared memory parallel programming, there's some things where you might get extra resilience, but believe me, if you have shared memory, the isolation isn't there, and if somebody fails, everybody fails, for the most part. Acceptable productivity. Parallel machines are now extremely cheap. They're much, much less expensive than a used car. When I still got into parallel first, they were much more expensive than my house. It is no longer possible to hide several months of programmer effort behind the cost of the machine. It used to be that after you spent $1 million on your machine, so you gave somebody a couple $100,000 to program it, okay, that's still small on a machine. Try that with a couple $100 netbook or laptop you might get that has dual core. You're not going to fit much time behind that, and I'm keeping myself awake here. Very awake, as it turns out. Okay, and the other thing is reasonable generality. The more general purpose your application, your program, your framework, your kernel, the more users there are to spread the work doing it, the cost of doing it, depending on what kind of program you're working with. Of course, this is actually, for me, has been a big deal because it's fun to do it. And if you're a hobbyist and it's fun, don't worry about these reasons. Just do it. Have some fun. Of course, you may have to check, maybe not, to check with your manager, your professor, your significant other, wife, kids, whatever. And they may have a different opinion, but I'll let you worry about that. Now, one thing to be careful of. I haven't mentioned anything about reliable software up here. And that's because, it better be reliable, but just like single-threaded software, it better be reliable. If you don't care about it being reliable, this is really simple and really fast, okay? Just return zero. Just hand back zero, that's your answer, and it'll be really fast. Doesn't have to be parallel. You can't get much faster than that. But getting the right answer might be important in some contexts, in which case this solution may not apply. Okay. And it turns out that if you look around at what people are doing, oftentimes they'll do a lot of work to make something parallel and have a lot of difficulty. There'll be poor performance. And we'll talk about, in a little lighthearted manner, why that might be the case. This is kind of the marketing pitch. We're going to have multi-core systems. They're all going to be running full out, just on a track, clear field. It'll be great. That's the marketing pitch. The reality is a little bit different, and has been for decades. The thing is that the CPUs are not running on a nice, flat, well-marked track. They're really running an obstacle course. What kind of obstacles might they run into? There's a good one. Memory references. Why do the CPUs have these big caches? They have the big caches because memory is really, really slow. So as soon as you have a memory reference that is not already in cache, your performance is gone for some period of time. It has to wait. Wait for that to go out and get to memory, and for the memory to figure out that it needs to hand the value back, and for the value to come back. Hundreds of instructions, sometimes thousands. Another thing is branch mispredictions. So that happens. It's kind of read ahead to figure out where to go, and suddenly, wham, that was the wrong way. We got to go this other way. And that can consume lots of cycles as it puts itself back together and fetches the instructions from the other path and gets it all set up and fills the pipeline again. A third problem you can run into is atomic instructions. And they seem so innocent. They're single instructions, compare and swap, atomic increment. But they aren't. I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, we got, it's an old style atom. This is the kind of way you might see atoms drawn when I was, maybe your age or younger, right? I don't do the art. I don't do art very well. This is my daughter's representation. I can take it up with her if you have objections, but but I kind of like it. Memory barriers. What happens to get performance, because these memory references are so slow, the CPUs will execute instructions out of order. You know, they're waiting for this memory reference, but they can go do these other things in the meantime and then finally catch up and do the memory reference. Well, sometimes that isn't the right thing to do. You really don't want to start executing the critical section until you've actually got the lock. Okay? That's the whole point of the lock, is to protect this instructions. So we have things called memory barriers to let the CPU know, by the way, don't go into the critical section until you got the lock, please. And of course, that messes up your performance. And another one is cache misses. This is related to the memory references. If you have a memory reference that isn't in the cache, you go to cache miss. But it's also possible to cache miss for some data that's really hot in the cache, because it might be in somebody else's cache. Okay? So this lock you're trying to get, well, somebody else just released it. The data structure covering that lock is in the other guy's cache. That means you get to wait until it shows up while everybody else is going running past you. And finally, don't even get me started on I.O. All right, you do an RPC somewhere, it's forever. Disk access, even with SSDs, SSDs are really fast. They're only 20 microseconds or 30 microseconds or whatever. Of course, that's if it's wired right into the CPU bus. And also, that's a lot of instructions. That's tens of thousands of instructions with today's CPUs. So these are all reasons why it's very easy to make a program parallel and have it go a lot slower than the original single-threaded program ran. And one of the main reasons to go parallel is to make it go faster, so we'd like to take some other approach to life. I'm not going to go into this in great detail. This is just one particular CPU. There are newer ones that are somewhat faster. But the basic thing to take out of this is, here's a clock period. Here's an atomic operation that misses the cache, 500 to 1. Okay, that's where the toilet paper roll comes in. With the American toilet paper, you end up with one square of toilet paper and somewhere around 450 or so squares for the rest of the roll. And one square versus the whole thing strung out is impressive. Okay, so all of this is just why we would have something like RCU. And the reason is RCU majors in things up here. And a lot of other synchronization mechanisms are down here. Now, of course, there's more to it than that. RCU is very specialized. It's used only in some places. But nonetheless, where it does apply, it works out quite nicely. So I'm not going to go into too much detail in this. What I'm going to do instead is focus on a couple diagrams just showing how it's used to give a flavor for it. One thing you can do is you can insert a new element into a list. We're going to use something very trivial here, where we just have a list that can only have one element. We have a global pointer. We're advancing through time doing operations. We start off with a null global pointer. There's nothing hanging off of it. And we're going to do a bunch of things, and eventually get to where we have a global pointer pointing to some data structure here filled out. And we're going to do that operation in such a way that readers can be dereferencing this global pointer at any point in time without grabbing locks, without slowing up, just going straight through the global pointer. And this is a useful approach if you have a data structure that's read a huge number of times and written extremely seldomly. The classic case of this in the Linux kernel would be the routing tables. Routing updates are extremely rare. If somebody takes out some big part of the internet, yes, you may have to send your packets somewhere else. But you're going to be sending a huge number of packets for each time that happens. Okay? Now, these are color-coded. The red stuff is stuff that's dangerous. A reader might be looking at that at any time, and you don't know whether a reader's looking there or not. The green stuff, these piece and this piece, are things that the guy doing the update has sole access to. Readers can't possibly look at it. So we go through a process here. We start off with nothing there. We have to have some way of protecting against multiple people updating, and I'm leaving that aside. Maybe use a lock. Maybe there's only one task and do the update, whatever it is. We allocate something. So we get this data structure here. Readers can't get at it. The values are whatever they are. It's not been initialized. Next thing we do is we initialize it. So we have these values now set out nicely. And the pointer still does not point to it, so readers still cannot access it. And then we use a primitive called RCUAssignPointer, which makes the pointer point to it in such a way that the readers are guaranteed to see the new values as opposed to somehow ending up with those values. And I'm not going to go through why that can happen. It took the alpha architects like 2 hours to convince me that it could about 10 years ago, and just trust me, okay? Now, we also have to worry about deletion, and I'm going to go through this as well. And here we have a list. We start off with a list. We have elements A, B, and C on the list, and we're going to go through a series of steps to remove element B. Okay, we're going to end up with just A and C at the end. And again, we're going to do this in such a way that readers can go charging through this list at any time, totally oblivious to the fact that we're changing the list without having to acquire locks or do anything unusual like that. Again, if we have a list that is being changed, it could be changed at any time, but is very rarely changed and read a whole bunch. Configuration data, for example, routing tables we already mentioned, security information is often this way, then this can be an advantage. Again, this is a special purpose. We don't use it everywhere. Okay, so again, the color coding is there. Red is stuff that readers can access at any time. A new reader could show up at any time. Yellow stuff is stuff that readers might be accessing, but new readers can't possibly get to it. Only old readers, okay, because at this point there's no path to it. And green stuff are things that readers can't possibly have an access to, and we can do whatever we want with it at that point. So we start off with this list. We just use a list deletion primitive. We remove it from the list. At that point, it's still sort of there. Now, A's pointer points around it. Its next pointer still points to C. So a new reader can't find it, but there could be a reader who just right here picked up this pointer, and then before they did anything else, we did the deletion, and they haven't accessed it yet, but they're going to sometime in the future. So what we have to do is we have to wait for all of these readers to get done. And RCU has a primitive synchronized RCU that allows that. I'm not going to go into great detail today on how that works. Later on, I'll have some URLs that you can look at that go through that in good detail. But once this magic primitive gets done, all these readers are gone, and we have this element B. Nobody can get to it anymore, and nobody's there anymore. So nobody's referencing it. We can therefore safely free it and end up with just this list we wanted to at the end. Okay? And the readers have to be taking some care. They have to use RCU dereference when they pick up a pointer. Okay, for technical reasons. Again, it has to do with the thing the alpha architects were beating me over the head with some years ago. Plus, it's a way of preventing the compiler writers from messing us up as well. And they also have to use an RCU read lock before they start going through the list. And when they get done with the list, they use RCU read unlock. Now, these don't necessarily generate any code. If you make these will just turn into nothing. The compiler won't even see them. There's pound sign define, RC read lock, preempt disable, and somewhere else there's pound sign define, preempt disable, new line. And again, I'm not going to go through how that works. We'll have some URLs people can look at that. So the basic way RCU works is that we have this time sequence going through. We make a change, and we make a change live, kind of a hot change, if you will, kind of like working on the electricity with the breaker still on so that you have to use rubber-handled screwdriver and rubber shoes. So we make the change. We wait for what's called a grace period. We wait for all the readers to drain out. And once that grace period finishes, we know that there can't be any readers looking at our data structure anymore, and we can then make changes that are destructive in nature, that readers can't tolerate, freeing things, for example. So the readers are happening concurrently. So we have an RC read lock to begin. We have RC dereferences in the middle and an RC read unlock at the end, as shown over there. And this is okay because he got done before we even started. This guy's okay because he started, but he finished before the end of the grace period. So he may have gotten the data we're trying to get rid of, but he left before we did anything to it. Similarly, this guy, I mean, he left right at the end, but still, he let go of anything before we did anything. This guy's okay because he started after we did the removal. So he can't possibly see the thing we removed. This is an error. If you have something like this, he might see the stuff we were trying to remove, and he might be still messing with it, while we're trying to free it. So this, if this happens, you have a buggy RCU implementation. Anybody tell me what the RCU implementation should do instead? What should this look like? Yeah.
The grace period should be extended.
Very good. Excellent. That's exactly what has to happen, just like that. So the has to extend so we cover that reader, and then the guy, everybody who might have that old information has let go of it before we go and free things. I'm not going to go into a huge amount of detail. This is for people that might want to review the slides afterwards. And this is just some things that might be used for, which, again, we don't want to worry about, and it actually is used, but not as much as locking. Here are some URLs you might look at to get more information on how it works and more detail on what you do with it. So it has advantages and disadvantages. It's not something you use everywhere. You use it where you care about the low overhead, the deterministic reside, deadlock immunity, and not having to do as much work in some cases, and easier handling of new references and against deletions. If updates need to be really fast, it might not be your first choice. If you're updating fairly often, then the fact that the stuff you remove goes cold in the cache before it's freed. So what normally happens, you free something, you put it in the free list, somebody else immediately allocates and uses it. It's still hot in that CPU's cache, so it's very fast. And that is disabled with RCU because you've remove it, you wait for several milliseconds for a grace period, and then by that time it's drained out of CPU's caches and you get misses. Updates run concurrently with readers, and that can be a good thing or a bad thing, but it's sometimes surprising. The thing we're worried about in this talk is the fact that it only runs in kernels. And the difficulty is two things. The Linux kernel implementation of RCU is extremely forgiving. You can do things like forget the RCU read lock, forget the RCU read unlock, and just sort of have the code there, and it'll mostly work. And we'll talk about an actual case where this caused me great pain last year. So we need something that's less forgiving, yet if we do that in the kernel, we end up causing some great pain through other parts of the kernel. And this is the case of being too forgiving. So there's this real-time RCU, preemptible RCU, that made it to mainline about a year ago. And things were looking good. It was working. I tested like crazy, and it was passing all the tests with all the configurations. And about 5 months later, Alexei says, you know, if I run this kernel build thing, I'm doing 170 parallel kernel builds with a bunch of different configurations. And so I say, okay, well, I'll try that. And I tried it, and I couldn't make it fail. So we went back and forth on what was going on. I sent him my config. I never got a config from him. And eventually on June, he actually tries RCU Torture, which is a test suite I wrote to really just hammer RCU really hard and make sure it's working. Well, he tries it, and it just falls over right away. And I can run RCU Torture all day. I can run it for many days, and I can't make it fail. So we're going back and forth what was going on, and about a month later, Nick, I'm going, okay, well, you know, and I still can't produce that either. So I've been beating my head against the code for months, trying to figure out what's going on, inspecting it, running tests, making RCU Torture more nasty, and nothing. So Nick actually went and did a whole bunch of work instrumenting RCU and checking it out and doing a bunch of stuff, and eventually finds a bug. It turns out that the test setup I was using would silently override me if I said CPU hot plug equals N. And the reason it would do that they're selected, so you must have meant to enable this, so I'll enable it for you. So I thought I was testing with CPU hot plug equals N, and I wasn't. And I had a really stupid bug. I was just failing to initialize at all in the case where CPU hot plug equals N, which caused preemptive RCU to conclude, there are no CPUs on the system. I don't have to wait for any of them. And what that meant is instead of carefully waiting for all the RCU read unlocks to show up to go there, it was just waiting for about a few tens of milliseconds saying, okay, good enough, we're done. And the amazing thing was is that even with it being totally broken in that way, It was still taking Alexi on anything resembling a normal workload. I mean, RSU torture is not a normal workload, all right? It's useful. It's saved me a lot of times. Not in this case, I'm afraid, but it has saved me a bunch of times. It was taking him 2 days on a 2-CPU machine with 170 parallel kernel builds for it to fail sometimes. Now, Nick, when he found the bug, he had this thing here. Annoyed this wasn't a crazy obscure error in the algorithm that I could fix. Spent all day debugging it. Had to make a special case. RCU torture didn't seem to trigger it. And a big RCU state logging structure logged millions of RCU state transitions and events. Oh, well. So this guy was disappointed that it was a simple, stupid bug on my part and not something obscure. And Alexi's response also did quite a bit to help me understand why he wasn't sending me a .config file.
Bastard!
In a response to Nick. So he was upset because he didn't find the bug first. Anyway, I guess he could have worse problems. But the thing is, what does... Please. Please, please, please. You know how much time I burned chasing this thing?
I want select as evil.
Select as evil? It's evil. It certainly caused me a fair amount of pain. It's useful in other cases.
Yeah,
yes.
Guys say you should never select something that you can also be prompted for. Things should either be purely select based, or they should be prompted for, and never both.
I like that.
And we violate that in a couple of.
I would have been happy if it would have. What I did was I wrote a script. We have this infrastructure where you just put in the list of config things you want, and it's a web based thing. And so I made it so I cut and paste that and dump it down the script in the build directory, and it would generate a C program that would yell at me if any of the things weren't set the way I'd asked them to be. So that was what I eventually did to get around that, but or at least to yell at myself if that happened.
In many cases, when you select where we should use default instead, and simply or simply have that config.
So and I'm not sure suspend resume was one of them, and I can't remember the other one. But for some reason, if you have suspend resume or the other one, you have to have CPU hot plug.
Yes.
I guess it would be, and the thing is that this is kind of an automated thing. I'm sure if I was to have done it in xconfig, that it would have just disappeared and not let me change it or something, but maybe not. I don't know. Okay. But this was using an automated thing. It was just using a script to do patch, apply patches to the config file. So, oh well. So I'm not going to go through in detail what you have to do to have a working RCU configuration. You can look at that later. But it became really obvious that this is important. Because if you can have it so where RCU isn't doing anything at all besides delaying, and have the system be actually pretty stable, I mean, I don't know about you, but I think that running 170 parallel kernel makes on a 2-CPU machine is a kind of excessive level of stress. Although I'm glad he did it, because otherwise we'd have the bug still in there. Okay. But... if that's what it takes to come up with a case, and what that was simulating was just all of the RC read locks and all the RC read unlocks just being dropped out of the kernel, all gone. You know, if somebody did this horrible bug that just they didn't use it correctly at all, and still it was pretty stable. So obviously we need something a little bit better to really stress test, really heavily stress test RCU algorithms. Okay, we be careful, and that's good. There is some sparse testing of them a little bit, but you know, you need to get the answer in less than 2 days. So my thought was to do this in user level. One might try to do it in kernel level, but the thing is that you need the grace period for some of the abuse. For example, if you just moved an RCU, if you just had the RCU unlocked too early, so you're doing some work after you got out of the read-side critical section, which you're not supposed to do. You need the critical section to cover the whole mess. You're going to get there pretty quickly hundreds of nanoseconds or microseconds. If I tweak the RCUs we have in the kernel now to make a grace period close in 100 nanoseconds, that kernel's going to be kind of unusable, okay? I mean, you could crank Hertz up to, 10 million or something like that, but I don't think that'll work. Or you could do any number of other things that just involve, like, grabbing several CPUs and having them do nothing but stare at the configuration, which certainly is going to work very well on a uniprocessor. Yes? So the question was, could you make the task schedule away on doing a RC read unlock? Hold that thought, that we're doing something similar. You could in some cases, but the problem is that you're allowed to use RC read unlock, for example, in NMI handlers. Okay. So we could do something like if not, we could do something kind of like that. To be honest with you, I didn't think. Well, the other reason I didn't think of it. Okay.
You might be able to busy loop.
Yeah. There's a bunch of things you could do, and all the ones I thought of. I didn't think of that one. Okay. But all the ones I thought of had some serious side effects that I decided were probably not good. So the at that point it's kind of like, well, in fact, Rusty did a bunch of stuff on this with pulling stuff into user mode and just pounding it to smithereens. And okay, well, you know, it's good enough for Rusty. What the heck, right? So let me make sure I understood that correctly. One idea would be to have a scheduling counter used in user space. Is this a way to implement RSU in user space
One string to pull.
Okay. That might be worth talking about. I'll go through what I actually did, but I'd like to talk to you about how that might work. So user-level RSU itself has several challenges. One thing, if you look at an RSU implementation, it does SMP processor ID a lot. And, well, you can sort of do that kind of, but you might be on some other CPU like that. There's nothing stopping the scheduler from deciding to move you. You also can't portably disable preemption. In fact, a lot of kernel hackers would refer you not do that at all. We had a lot of an argument with Oracle some years ago about that, in fact. And there's no equivalent of an in-kernel scheduling clock interrupt. I mean, there's signals, but the problem is a lot of applications want to use signals for their own purposes, and they're not going to be really happy with RSU stealing it. And the other thing is, if you were going into more general, if we're going to do this in user space, you might as well make it so applications use it, right? And for to do that, the problem is you write an RSU library. Not only do you not know what the applications using it now are, another application might not be written yet, and so you can't make any assumptions about what the application can do. And in particular, you can't assume that the application is going to call RSU QSCTR Inc. every so often, which is what the in-kernel version requires. Okay. So what do we do? Well, what we do here, instead of focusing on CPUs, we focus on processes or threads. And that's a little bit of a cheat because, in theory, you could have millions of threads, but I'm willing to take a limited thing where we only support a couple hundred as a start, okay? And if somebody needs more later, we can worry about it later. So we can't disable preemption, but on the other hand, if we focus on a processor thread, then we don't need to disable preemption because the thread can't preempt away from itself. I mean, no matter what it does, it's still that thread, all right? In kernel scheduling clock interrupt, there's a couple of ways we can deal with this. One is to drive grace pre-as totally from the update side primitives. In other words, you do a synchronized RSU and instead of just waiting for things to happen in the background, it actually actively goes and detects the end of the grace period. And that's what I do in a number of cases. That has some consequences. The other thing is to provide separate threads for this purpose. In other words, have a thread whose job it is to close grace periods from time to time. And I've gone with this initially. Maybe this may be something we would have to do if we wanted to scale to thousands or hundreds of thousands of threads. Let's control the application. Well, okay, we're not going to control the application. However, if we don't control the application, we have to add some overhead to some of the primitives, and therefore we have a more optimized version, which we'll see. Okay, this is a really, really simple RCU. It's not something you would use if you care about performance, but in this case, we care about bug finding, right? So RSU read lock. We have a global variable, and we atomically increment it. And that's, by the way, going to be really, really slow on a big multiprocessor. But again, performance is taking a bit of a backseat for this bug finding exercise at this point. And also, we can't optimize this. I just want to start this way. Now, we also, in this case, need an SMPMB here, because the way that the kernel gets away with this is that they know they have the scheduling clock interrupt. And so what happens is the scheduling clock interrupt sees, oh, the state changed, and if it needs to, it does an SMB, okay, because it just requires the processor to do the memory barrier. The fact that it does it in an interrupt as opposed to in the mainline code it's okay, it doesn't matter. In this case, we don't have the interrupt, so we're just going to take it in the shorts, we're going to do the memory barrier here. Besides, if we're atomically incrementing a global variable, you know, who cares about a memory barrier, right?
Can you be scheduled?
So can we be scheduled from one CPU to another between those two lines of code? Indeed, we can. So this is a global variable. What happens is we'll atomically increment the global variable. So let's say it was 0, there was nobody in a read-side critical section. It'll now be 1. If we get scheduled another CPU, the context switch code has to do the memory barriers for us, because otherwise the CPU that knew the task needs to be able to see what it did on the other CPU. So we're covered there. And because it's a global variable, if somebody else were to do one, they'd either be the one that incremented 1 or the one that incremented 2. Either way, it's now 2. Okay? Go ahead. Yes, I was too lazy to put that in my user code stuff. So. Yeah, the point, very good point, there's an optimized version of SMPMB that is used after atomic ink. The reason for that is things like x86, and atomic ink implies a memory barrier, just naturally. Other things like power and I think itanium, the atomic ink doesn't necessarily make a barrier, so you have to do one yourself. And by having SMPMB after atomic ink or something like that, I'd have to look it up. What it does is, depending on your architecture, either it does a memory barrier or it doesn't, depending on whether it needs to. So yeah, good point. And then unlock, we just do it in the reverse. We need to have this memory barrier to make sure that the read side critical section stays in the read side critical section for the processors where atomic ink doesn't imply it. And then we just decrement it. We could just use a write barrier, I think. The thing is that you might have a read in here that needs to stay inside. Okay. Because you might just be going down a list. So I think it needs to be a full barrier. For x86, you don't care. He cares about power, though. Yeah. So anyway, this is horribly expensive, but it's pretty simple. Basically, in the update side, it's pretty straightforward with one proviso. All we have to do is, I'm not sure why I have the T. I'm sorry, ignore that. We just have a memory barrier, and then we just sit and we do that to make sure that the update we did is seen before we go and check what everybody else is doing. We just hear spinning until the thing ends up being zero. Good point. Very good. That's he beat me to this part right here. What if it never gets to zero? It might not. You know, it could be that you have a lot of CPUs and there's always somebody in a read-side critical section at all times, in which case this will wait forever. So one thing you can do is you can have two counters and flip their roles back and forth. But I wanted to show the absolute bonehead simplest possible thing. So that's good debugging. Yes? So I've done somewhere between 10 or 15 different little tweaks on this, and what I'll do is I'll show an even stupider one than this in a moment, and then I'll go through one of the smarter ones. Okay. So if you thought that was trivial, try that. For one thing, both the read and update side fit on one page. All right. And what we're going to do is when we do RC read lock, we're just going to grab a global spin lock. All right. And RC read lock is going to release it. I mean, who needs read side parallelism anyway, right? We're debugging here. And synchronized RCU, people looked at networking code in 2.4 may kind of recognize this approach to life. They had something kind of similar. You just acquire the lock and then immediately release it. Well, you can't acquire the lock until all the readers are done, and then they're all gone, and then you release and you're happy, although it may be a little slower than you'd like. And of course, there's one other problem. With normal RCU, you could have a case where you acquire a lock, do an RC read lock, do some stuff, RC read unlock, release the lock. And somewhere else, with that same lock, RC read lock, and then acquire the lock, do something, and release the lock, and then RC read unlock. Try that with this puppy, and it'll deadlock. Okay? So this is really simple and stupid. It's a kind of a way of explaining how things work. But if you try that on an arbitrary algorithm in the kernel, it's not going to cut it for you. Ooh, multiple locks. Okay. So it's kind of like...
This is an API. So when we shut down the network device, we used to have a queue lock that we lock and unlock to make sure all the transmitters are gone. Now we have multiple NAPI structs, so we do it at once.
That smells like something that Dusty would use before, actually.
There's also another kind of T-synchronized RCU or what we told you to do with readers
around. I'm sorry? Yeah, and the thing is, there can only be one reader. You'd have to wait for the reader, but there can only be one of them at a time. Yeah, and there's no read-side parallelism, so there's no concurrency. This is a bad solution, but a but one that meets the letter of the law of RCU semantics, right? Okay, so I'm not sure if he's getting a picture of the slide. Yeah, it looks like he is, so I'll let him get a picture of the slide. All right. There's some other approaches. I'm not going to go in detail with these, but I'm going to take one particular one and deal with it a little bit better. Split counter is what gets around Dave's objection about, hey, it might never get to zero, so you just use a pair of them. You can also have a per-thread split counter, which I'm not going to go through this. If somebody immediately spots what the bug in this is, I'll be very impressed and shake your hand and have you look at inspect my code in the future. But there is a bug. And there's an easy workaround. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at a little bit better approach that actually gets read side parallelism and has low cost on the read side, and the update isn't too bad either. What we're going to do is we're going to have a global counter again, but what we're going to do is the readers aren't going to mess with it. They're going to look at it, but they're never going to change it. The updaters are going to add 2 to it each time they want to do a grace period. So it's only going to take on even values. And so it would look like this guy here, 0, 2, 4, 6, 8. Okay, so this white line, which I don't know if you can see the color from there, is the global counter right here. Each reader thread is going to have its own counter, and it's what it's going to do is it's going to pick up this value, it's going to add 1 to it, and put it in its copy. So a given thread might have something like this bluish line, which may or not be distinguishable, starts off at 0, goes up to 3. Okay, so at this point, while it's 3, it's in a read side critical section. And then goes up and eventually goes to 4 at the unlock, so now it's even value. So a given thread, if it's inside a read side critical section, it has an odd numbered value in its counter. If it's outside, it's an even value. Furthermore, we can tell which the old and the new ones are. Okay, because an old counter, so right here, for example, we went up, we became 2. This is a new one because it's bigger. All right. At this point, once we try to do another grace period, it's now old, it's smaller. So all we have to do is wait until each thread's counter is either even or greater than the current value we've got there, and at that point the grace period is ended. Okay. And the cool thing about this is that if you're in user mode and the thread goes off and blocks outside a read-side critical section forever, it stays even and you can ignore it. Okay, you don't have to do something weird to either track it or there are some ways of getting around that, but and I may implement some of them at some point if I need to, but I decided not to this year or this past year. So the read side is really trivial again. And I get thread var is kind of like get CPU var. I sort of half plagiarized the kernel interface, which of course changed now, so I'm out of date, but hey, you know. Anyway, we just take the global counter, we add 1 to it, we stick it in our value, and we still need the memory barrier because we need to keep the read side critical section inside. And this again is a consequence of the fact we don't have the equivalent of the scheduling clock interrupt at user level. And unlock, we just do the opposite thing. We do the barrier again to keep the critical section inside, and then we just copy the value directly, which means at this point we have an even value and we're seen as being outside. There is one problem here. I'll give us a couple seconds if somebody wants to try to spot it. Go ahead. Wraparound actually should be handled because what I do, I'll show you in the next page. Yes.
Nesting.
Very good. Exactly. Nesting. If we nest, we're in a read-side critical section, and then somebody says I want a grace period, and then we nest, and suddenly we look like we didn't start before it did, and that's bad. Okay. So to your point, which was about the update side, what it was going to do. What we're going to do, we have a memory barrier again to separate things out. Spin locks have memory barriers, but not all architectures guarantee that they're impermeable both directions. We add 2 to the global counter, we have another memory barrier, and then we go through each thread, and while that thread is odd and it's smaller than the current value, we wait. You could poll, but if I'm going to make it real nasty, I'll comment out that poll so that the grace period closes really quickly, right? If I was doing it for efficiency, I might wait a few milliseconds each round to avoid chewing up extra CPU. But I'm not worried about extra CPU, I'm worried about finding bugs. And then we release the lock, do another memory barrier, and we can then do our destructive operations. So again, this ends up being pretty simple. And it also allows us, by removing this weight, to get through a grace period extremely quickly. Okay? If there's one guy we're waiting for in a regicide critical section, as soon as he releases it, we'll see it and continue. All right. So, let's see here. So we've got, this does a bunch, if you're looking for a production quality thing, it does a bunch of things fairly nicely. As Rusty noted, we don't have freely nestable regicide primitives. And also, because we have a global lock, our update site is not scalable. And the read side is deterministic, and it's reasonably low overhead, but you got that memory barrier there, which isn't perfect. So I color it yellow, saying it's okay, but not great. At this point, there's another one that gets around the nestability thing, but I'm not going to go through that in detail. I'd be happy to talk about it later. It's kind of have a fat bottom bit, and if you do that, then you get rid of the problem about nesting them, but you still have the other problems. The update site scalability can be taken care of in a number of ways, but I'm not going to worry about that much at this point. What I'm going to do instead is talk about RCU torture, because that's what we use to test this. What I did was, what RCU torture does in this case is we have an array of structures. Okay? And the readers traverse this RCU stress current pointer, look at this value, and sit there for a while, and then verify the value is either 1 or 0. We'll talk about why that works later. What the updater does is advances the pointer, okay, increments each value modulo the number of elements in the array. So this is going to become 1, this is going to become 0, this will become 7, and so on. And then does a synchronized RCU. All right? So what happens after he's done that, we have something looking like this. RCU stress current is advanced to the new place, so the new readers will come in here. There might still be some old readers that picked up the old value but didn't look at this yet, so that's why this is gray. There might still be some people here. There would not be anybody here, because that would have been two grace periods ago. So readers can see 0, they can see 1. If they see a 2 or bigger, RCU is broken, and it complains bitterly about that. And this is the code that goes through that. It's not all that important. I'm not going to look at it carefully. This is the reader code. We RCU read lock. We pick up the pointer. We spit spinning for a little bit just to force some time to pass. And then we pick up the pipe count, which is the number inside the array element you saw. We do RCU read lock, and then we do some checking afterwards.
Won't the compiler kill you at 4?
I'm sorry?
Won't the compiler kill you 3 and 4 and turn it into a garbage physical element?
That's a global variable, so I force the compiler to keep track of that because the value goes outside of what it can see. So it yes, but that was a mistake I did actually make was to fail to force the compiler to actually generate that code. So what I'm going to do, it would be illegal to move this statement outside of the RC readside critical section. Okay, because this is. We've got an RCU dereference, we pick up this pointer, and then we're dereferencing the pointer. That has to stay in the RCU critical section to be legal. Since I'm trying to find bugs, what I'm going to do is I'm going to reverse the order of those two statements, as shown down here in red. I'm going to add some malice to RCU read unlock in order to raise the probability of catching this as a problem. And since I'm picking this up out here, now it's perfectly legal for RCU to go through many grace periods right here between those two statements. So I should be able to see violations. And it's a good thing if RCU can detect those. I mean, that's what we're trying to do, is catch problems like that. And this is the results of doing that. I've got a bunch of different implementations. RCU lock is the stupid one with just a single global lock. RCU RCG is a stupid one with a single global reference count. This one takes the thing of splitting the reference counts, as was suggested. This one has a per-thread version, and this one has a faster update. I'm not going to go through what all of these do. But I have the read side performance on 64 CPUs. In other words, you have 64 threads all running concurrently, doing nothing but RCU read lock, RCU read unlock. And you look at the time it takes for each one to go by. And this is not particularly optimized. But as you can see, if you have the global lock, you're up at 17 microseconds, which is pretty horrible. And if you use the global reference counters, you're even worse. Okay. So. What we do is we, for the malice, what we do is we just put a little for loop in there. And again, we do the tricks to make sure the compiler doesn't mess us up. But we either don't have a for loop at all, so this is normal RC read unlock, or we spin 100 times, 1,000 times, 10,000 times on a local variable. And one thing you can see is that the single lock is kind of malicious by from this point, just by its very existence. You got about a 1 out of 5 chance of catching the problem when you do that. Whereas so these other guys aren't, if it's blank, that means we ran 10 seconds going full bore, going through that torture, and we didn't catch any problems. As you increase, you get higher and higher probability of catching that bug. And also, it's much more even. You end up with the higher performance guys here. I mean, you can see initially the guys with the poor performance are the ones that are being caught. As you go out here, even the low performance ones, except for these two guys. The reason is that these two guys work in user space the way that RC read lock works in the kernel with not config preempt. And as a result, the grace period really is kind of a sloppy thing. And so we just never detect it, no matter how long we do it, because the grace period is determined not by where you put RC read unlock and RC read lock, but rather where you denote a quiescent state. So you have to use one of the not super efficient versions to make this happen.
They require the application to...
Yes. That's absolutely right. The key thing about these is that they require you know something about the application. So you couldn't use these in an arbitrary library. You would have to, the application would have to call the quiescent state thing periodically to make it work. Or,
also
go ahead.
Event-driven applications, for example, that always go back to the original.
Yeah, event-driven application, one thing, this particular code, I have a way of saying, look, don't pay attention to me anymore because I'm going off for a long time. For example, if you're reading from the network, and then you come back in. Interestingly enough, I seem to have a problem with initialization errors in RCU because I had a mess up in this guy where I wasn't causing the thread to say he was there initially. So, yeah, thank you. And we're almost there. So this is just some future work. I just have bare bones and not the rest of the API. I'd like to actually make this try this in user-level applications. There's some students at one of the universities in the States that are they've been thinking about this. I'm not sure if they're going to make it happen or not, but it'd be really cool if they did. So it looks like user RCUs, level RCUs really is possible, even for library functions. We end up with good grace period latency, really low, as in hundreds of nanoseconds, and not bad read side performance. And we end up with full RCU semantics, even with the stupid implementations. There's some more stuff you can look at if you want to know more about RCU. And I've actually got the source code for these user-level RC implementations available in this Git tree here, along with some write-ups on them. And they're available under GPL v2 or later. I'm sorry, it took me 5.5 years to get GPL v2 or later. I don't have LGPL. With that, thank you all very much for your time and attention, and see how things go.